I mean, we're not talking about, you know, a flow from some other part of the anatomy. But we're talking specifically from the reproductive organs.
Yeah, but even we take a look at the reproductive organ, the things that are mentioned here are serious diseases, even as of today.
Correct, correct.
Let's say that through the reproductive organs, mm-hmm. you had cancer, let's say.
Yeah.
Which would be not concerned with reproduction of the ailment. But this would all apply.
You're making a very valid point. Obviously, the Torah at this particular point is not talking about cancer.
Yeah.
But nevertheless, if you see a symptom that is not normal, then definitely requires further investigation to see whether that symptom heals up by itself or not. I mean, this is understood.
Yeah. Now, see, they're tying all this into prohibitions on prayers and so forth.
Correct. But as I said, I mean, we know that the punchline is that Rabbi Yehuda's opinion finally is going to be vindicated, namely that we don't apply it today. Right?
Mm-hmm.
But nevertheless, there was a period when they tried to enforce this edict in order to make people feel how precious and how sacred is the recital of the Kriya Shema, recital of Brachas, the study of Torah, how important it is that you should have a certain attitude towards it, that if you should have a seminal omission, as I say, here we're not talking necessarily, you know, just of what we would call a wet dream or something like that, but the most common occurrence is the fact that the man has intercourse. And this is the basic reason why
he has to go to mikveh.
Right.
But I think what he's referring to, listen, is the problem of the Zav. The Zav felt prohibited for 7 days from Kriyat Shema and other things.
Yeah.
And I think if I'm getting this correctly, and that there are other medical causes for these symptoms.
Of course there are other medical causes,
but
we understand.
They,
that's why I don't know whether the word gonorrhea is correct either. I mean, even though some people translate, you know, they think
these
that's
people suffer the sanctions and not being able to...
But the point is, that's not so, because the rabbis say they should peril themselves, and then they can...
The point of view of the rabbis is that they are still permitted to study, right, if they have a seminal emission, or whatever it may be.
Or is up.
Right.
The Zavim are still
even though it's
study?
Not good. Pardon me?
The Zavim are allowed
yes.
to study?
Yes.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Provided,
this is the point over here. Right.
Provided they travel themselves.
Right. Yeah.
Provided they go to the mikveh.
But no, the interim period before they go to the mikveh. This is my point.
Yeah, but that's still a Zav. Because until they cleanse themselves. However, to study Torah, yes, but they have to immerse themselves in the mikveh, even though the mikveh enables them to study Torah, but it doesn't enable them to be free from the restrictions of the Zav, because they're still in that state. As I said, besides, you know, how many times you see something, you also have to count days, clean days. Okay.
Well, let me see. Yeah. Again. What are the restrictions of the Zav? Maybe I'm
essentially, the restriction on the Zav is really more the question about Tumah. The fact that if he sits on a chair and you sit on it, that chair can contract Tumah from him and pass it on to you, okay? If, for example, he touches food, okay, and then you eat that food that he has touched, it could be transferred to you, the Tumah. I don't mean that the Ziva would be, but the Tumah could, as you can see.
I understand.
Okay?
I think if I understand his point, he's saying that today there may be medical causes which result in symptoms that are indistinguishable.
Correct, correct.
What the Rabbanim saw as sexually transmitted diseases.
Right, right.
So this poor fellow, this hope will never be me, but now faces the humiliation of to Uma, whereas he really has no cause but a medically understandable cause. Am I correct in getting
that? Yeah, you're good.
Okay, so now I post this question. Maybe we're racing too far ahead. Maybe we should do Indian first.
We will
How do we?
Okay.
How do you?
No, but
that?
I simply want to say, I mean, look, that we have to realize that this is a case where it was operative for some time, but obviously it became inoperative.
Mm-hmm.
Because they saw that the...
It
became impractical. Okay? It was a takana to begin with. The Torah didn't say. Okay? The Torah didn't say you're not allowed to say Krishna, not allowed to study Torah because you were Zelda. The Torah doesn't say that at all.
Mm-hmm.
But this was a special takana that was put in by Ezra in order to make people realize the seriousness of the study. They should take it with seriousness. You know, they should take a serious attitude towards learning Torah.
And he justifies it by sniffing.
Right.
Right?
Yeah, well,
he justifies it.
Right, correct. This is
but
the
not
interpretation
necessarily,
of right.
Not necessarily
exactly.
A Torah eating.
Yeah, the comparison to what happened in Mount Sinai. But you're absolutely right. In other words, you can have what we call an asmachta. Asmachta means that you cite scripture, but nevertheless, I mean, it's understood that this is not, you know, as if the Torah itself really said this. It's that you find an allusion to it, you see. An allusion to the practice in the wording of the Torah. But the Torah doesn't specifically state that. So, you're correct in that. Of course, I just want to add one more word. I mean, for example, when a woman is anita, okay, she has to examine herself. I say she has to examine herself when she thinks, you know, that the flow is about to end. Just as incidentally, she has to examine herself before she has a period. You know, the day before, she has to examine herself if she has a what we call a vesus kavua. In other words, she has, a regular period. She has an irregular period already. It's another problem. But if she has a regular period, she has to examine herself just before the time that she knows that she's going right. And as I say, you know, once she has stopped flowing, she has to examine herself again, okay, and do it on a daily basis, actually, until the 7-day period has passed. Now, what if she sees, you know, a stain?
But she started.
And the question is the stain red? Is the stain yellow? Is the stain something else, or whatever it may be? You understand? Green, whatever the stain may be. Now, in this particular case, red, no question that she is a nida. With yellow, there may be a question as to whether she is or she's not. So that, or pink stain or something, pink she would probably be considered a nida too, you know, because pink and red are associated. Okay, that you have to show actually to a Talmud Chacham, you know, who's an expert in being able to decide these things. You remember, we had many weeks ago, we had a story about King David, who says, take a look at the difference between my being the king of Israel and other kings of other nations, you know, that they they live a chasah shatav, they make war, they eat, they drink, they do whatever they do. But I am busy, he says, judging the people, and also trying to permit women, you know, to be able to live together with their husband, so that he became an expert on being able to determine what these things are. So in the Shulchan Aruch we have a law that if you can, for example, attribute a stain to something other than the fact that it is normally coming from the womb, from the uterus and so on, right? So in that particular case, we have to, you know, assume that that is a possibility. As for example, we know that she's hurt herself somehow or other on the inside. Okay, that has to be taken into consideration. So as I say, I mean, this is not an easy area, you know, to be able to
make it
a judgment. Exactly. I know I once had a problem. Came to Rabbi Bick. Said anything, also, that's all there is to it. It's prohibited.
It's prohibited.
Right.
That's the answer to your question. He was Mark Mir.
He was Mark Mir, right. You know, Rob Dick happens to be a very great common prophet. If you live in New York, you've heard of Rob Dick.
That's an easy
He's
way
a
out.
Very old man, but now very ill. But the point is, you know, but very learned. So that I'm sure that if he felt, you know, that there was something, But it's a lot easier to simply say it's prohibited.
It's easier to be mafra than to be lenient.
Yeah. So, look, I abided by his decision. That's all there is to it. Okay. Anyway, to continue right now.
Right.
Okay. So, Emo Sefer HaMisha Meshes Ras Adam Tzvichot Tadilo. So, how about the next part of the statement that we quoted from the Mishnah, not this, you know, the Mishnah that has now been cited over here a couple of lines before, where it says that if a woman had intercourse and she sees blood during the intercourse, or so she has to title herself, Laman Katani Law, tell me, who is the authority then who would be in agreement with this? Ilayim on the Rabbonon, if you say it is the rabbis, the Mshita. Then yeah, obviously it is so. In other words, the rabbis would say, if she wants to say Krishna right now, let her title herself, even though it's not going to help, all right? Mazov Sharor Keri, after all, here we have a case of the Zod, who saw a seminal flow, right? The Miyakora Labat Vilohu, to begin with, he wasn't permitted to be titled because he hadn't yet completed the number of days that he had to be clean, right? And yet the Chayvei Rabbonon, and yet the rabbis required him to be toivel himself if he had a seminal mission during this time in order to be able to study Torah or to say Krishna. So Ham Shameshes, Ras Adam, a woman who has intercourse and she sees blood during the intercourse, the Miyakorabas Tvilahi, to begin with, I mean, she should immerse herself. Well, of course she can. Certainly she should immerse herself. Elalav Rabbi Yehuda, but if it's not the Rabbanan, then maybe it's Rabbi Yehuda, but Davka Katanande. And maybe the reason why this Mishnah points out specifically Mishameshes, Ruas, or Nida, right? Einot Tzvichot Vila, that the woman who has intercourse and she sees blood during the intercourse, she does not require immersion of a Balkeri, greater Machayev, but maybe someone who's simply had a seminal intercourse, has had a seminal flow, yet Rabbi Yehuda would say they should be Toivel. So he says, lo. Then in that case, it can't be. Why? Because he would have said, Teimon Mevorech, he wouldn't have said, Mevorech el Maharher. In other words, if Rabbi Yehuda really felt that maybe someone with a seminal flow should be titled before he should say Krishna, then he would not have said in the Mishnah that we had on page 20, on Chof, that Mevorech, which means specifically what? He recites the blessings and understood it. He recites a blessing. How do we recite a blessing? You say it, right? So he would not have said at that one, Mevorech el Mahari. He would have said simply, think a blessing, right? If Rabbi Yehuda felt, you see, they're now turning back again to an argument. Maybe Rabbi Yehuda felt that, okay, if the guy was a Zov, and he saw seminal flow, so he shouldn't, Rabbi Yehuda said he didn't have to immerse himself, right? So maybe the implication then would be that any other person who simply had a seminal flow should immerse himself. Maybe that's Rabbi Yehuda's position. So we say, no, it could not be Rabbi Yehuda's position. Why? Because the Mishnah that we had just the page before, where it says that Rabbi Yehuda Omer Mevorech Lefaneh Vachreho, right? Or Lefaneh Vachrehem, says that you have to recite the bracha. He wouldn't have said that. What language would he have said? He would have used the expression maharher, the way the Mishnah started off, which represented the view of the majority of the rabbis, but not the view of Rabbi Yehuda. But maybe Rabbi Yehuda would have been in agreement with them, and then in that case he should have said also maharher and not mevorech, alright? You understand what I'm saying? In other words, they're taking the language over here to see, can we really say that Rabbi Yehuda had such a position? No. Because then the Mishnah, where it quotes him again specifically, And we're only talking there about a Balkeri, we're not talking about Zob Shero Keri, okay? Only about a Balkeri. It doesn't say Maharher, but what does it say? It says Mevorech. Right. So specifically then, Rabbi Yehuda would not require it, right? Veho Tanya, Meisle Rabbi Yehuda Hirhur. And can we say, first of all, line 3, all right, that Rabbi Yehuda holds this business of Hirhur? In other words, that you can think of bracha but not, you know, and get away with having to say it, yeah? So the Hotanya, didn't we learn that Balkeri she'ein lo mum litbo, she'ein lo mayim litbo, korei kriya shma v'yenem mevorek l'ilponehu l'yachreho? Didn't we learn a Tosefta that happens to be, which says that if a person is suffering from a seminal flow and he doesn't have water in which to immerse himself, then what should he do? So they say at that point, Korei Kriya Shema, he should recite Krishna, the Yena Mevorech Lelefonehu Leachrechu, and he should not recite the bracha either before or after the Shema, right? The Yoichel Pito, he eats his piece of bread, Mevorech Leachrechu, and he recites the Birkas Hamazon, and afterwards, the Yena Mevorech Lefonehu, and he does not recite the bracha before it, Avol Maharhil Belibo. But rather, what does he do? Thinks he simply thinks the bracha, okay? The Yenu Motzi Bisposot, and he does not actually utter it with his lips. Divrei Rabbi Meir, this is the opinion of Rabbi Meir. And Rabbi Yehuda Omer, Bein Kach Hu Bein Kach, makes no difference. Motzi Bisposot, he does recite the bracha specifically. He does say it with his mouth, definitely. So we see then that if this is the case, that Rabbi Yehuda definitely is in disagreement with this Takana Vesra to begin with, okay? But now, we're not finished yet with the analysis. As you can see, they want to go another step. All right, so now they continue and they say as follows. Omar Rab Nachman by Yitzhak. So Rab Nachman by Yitzhak, you know, thinking about the situation, so he says, Nason Rabbi Yehuda ki hilchos derekeres. He says that what Rabbi Yehuda did is to treat Krishna and let's say you know, Birkas HaMazon, treated on the same basis as if he would teach, as if he would treat learning Hilchos Derech Eretz. Now first of all, I have to tell you, what is Derech Eretz? We know what Derech Eretz means in general.
Obedience.
Huh?
Obedience.
No, Derech Eretz,
courtesy.
Derech Eretz means that, courtesy. You have to know how to behave with human beings. Yeah. This is essentially what it is. Derech Eretz is how you behave as a human being, okay? Showing respect, this is one translation of Derech Eretz. But as you know, for example, we have a statement in Pirkei Avos which says, Yofet HaMetom Derech Eretz, that the study of Torah is beautiful when it's combined with Derech Eretz, and that can be understood in various ways. One is the way, I mean, that you have to not only be a scholar, but you have to be a mensch. This is one thing. But another translation of Yofet HaMetom Derech Eretz is that you have to have, in addition, you know, to sitting and learning Torah, you also have to have a worthwhile occupation. This is also Derech Eretz. A person is a human being by virtue of the fact that he goes out, he works, he tries to make a living, he has a family to support, I mean, he does all these things. This is also Derech Eretz. So we have in the Talmud, if you take a look at a very complete Talmud, okay, you have naturally all these volumes over there that, as we see over here, okay, with the various tractates. Sometimes it may be one great big tractate, and sometimes it may be two or three tractates, you know, bound together and so on and so forth, okay. There was also in ancient times something which was not technically part of the Talmud, but nevertheless they had a number of Sephorim, which were given, you know, the status of works to be studied, although not on the same level of authority as the regular tractates of the Talmud.
Additional commentaries.
No, well, I wouldn't call them exactly that, but generally they dealt with a specific issue. As for example, Derech Eretz dealt with how a person should conduct himself. Okay. You have, for example, let's say Maseches Mezuzah. Okay, The Gemara mentions, you know, different things about the mezuzah, particularly in the Gemara and Menachos. Same thing is true for tefillin and tzitzis and so on. But over there you have a chapter which is devoted to these things, okay? But nevertheless, you know, while you have a halacha here and a halacha there and so on, in these special tractates that were written, so they dealt specifically with various laws. Then you have, for example, like Masachas Sefer Torah, which deals with, again, how do you write a Sefer Torah, and you know, the treatment of the parchment and the ink and everything else, and what are brachas to be recited before and after, and haTorahs and things like that and so on. So that all these are separate preceptors, but as I say, they never had exactly the same high stand, shall we say, the same level of acceptance, so to speak, as the regular Masechtas, the regular tractates in the Talmud. Okay, so Derech Eretz is one of them. So what they're implying is over here, that is what Rav Nachman is saying over here, is simply that, well, maybe Rav Yehuda would feel, you know, that certain types of study you don't have to immerse yourself for, but maybe for a higher level of study, maybe you should require. You understand? This is the argument now that they're going to pursue.
You know, I guess I thought that it's interesting that they say that you can think of prayer.
Yeah.
That's centered in the debate. Not to speak it.
Right.
You know, this is an interesting point of all.
Yeah. Yeah. We discussed this a few weeks ago, Sam.
Yeah, okay.
And at that time, no, I said they wanted to take it. There was, you know, a difference of opinion. They mentioned again, I mean, the difference of opinion between Rabbi Yehuda, who feels that it's not enough that you should actually say a prayer with your lips, you know, you should utter it, okay?
Yeah.
As compared to Maharher, which is, you know, it was accepted as a possibility. The Psak, in other words, the general decision is that unless there are extenuating circumstances, you should recite a bracha. If there are certain circumstances where you feel that you can't do it, God forbid, you know, we know that there are people, for example, that, that they don't have a voice, their voice, whatever it may be, or they've had, you know, this operation on the larynx, which we're all too familiar with these days, or something like that.
Yeah, but then
in that case,
you can go afield.
Right.
You can
really
go afield, because a person can speak a prayer,
but
his mind is in something else.
That's another subject. Correct. But normally, you must concentrate.
That becomes, then it's a matter of Kavanah.
Right. And that already is a different area, right?
Yeah, no, I said it's going into another area.
Kavanah, which means, you know, that when we recite a prayer, it should be with the intention, really, to fulfill.
Yeah.
And to think about what it is that you're saying, and what is your intention, and so on. And all this is what we mean by Kavanah. All right, so now, this is the argument that they're going to pursue in their analysis. Okay. So Amar Rav Nachman by Yitzchok, so he said, maybe Ason Rav Yehuda ki hilchos derech eretz, that, you know, he considered, you know, the words of Krishna, let's say, on a par with hilchos derech eretz. D'tanya, because we have learned the hodatom nevonechon nevonechon. Notice again, they're using, you know, these two verses, but as you know, when you quote a verse and you derive a lesson, as we would say, a drash from it, then very often it lends itself to many differing types of interpretations. The Gemara says, Kefata shefoitzit tzela, just as when you have a hammer and you take a rock and you hit the hammer with it, it splits into all kinds of different pieces. So likewise, the same pasuk can be split into all kinds of different interpretations. So now again we have an interpretation of these two verses. The Hodatom Nebonecho Nebonecho, teach them to your children and to your children's children, the Siv, and immediately following the Siv Basrei, and it's written right afterwards, Yom Asher Amarato Lepnei Arashem Lekecha Chorev, the day upon which you stood before the Lord your God in the Chorev. So Nala Halon, just as when you were at Mount Sinai, it was Be'emor, Be'yira, Be'reseis, Zeyah, or the Ziyah. All right. In other words, how did the people of Israel react when they stood at Mount Sinai? It was with fear and trembling and trepidation and shaking or quaking, whichever way you want to translate it, okay? This is the way, you know, they reacted. So afkan, so likewise when it comes to, say, Krishna, or when it comes to learning Torah, it should also be with an attitude of what? Amor, yiror, resesavaziyah. You should also approach the study of Torah with fear and trembling and trepidation. In other words, you have to take it seriously. It's not something, you know, just to rattle off, treat in a mechanical way, mindlessness, you know. You have to approach it, you know, with the true concentration of feeling, you know, for what it is that you say. So, Mekan Omro, on this basis, they said, Hazovim Aksoroyim, Ovoyan Alanidos, Putom Nekros, Putom Nevim Iksuvim. So, point is then that from this Tosefta, they learned as follows. And here you see that their law is quite different already. What? First of all, Zovim. Okay? We now know who are Zovim. Okay? People who suffer from this law, the Hamid Soroyim, and also leprosy. People who are suffering from leprosy, Uvoyan al Nidos, or people who have had intercourse and discovered that the woman is a Nida, right? Mutarim, they are permitted likros, they are permitted to read Torah, Unavim, Uksuvim, because these are the three parts of the Bible, as you know, the Torah, the prophets, and the Ksuvim, the holy writings. Lishna is for Mishnah, they're also permitted to learn Mishnah. Ugemara, right? Uvahalochas, Uvahagodos. They're permitted to learn all these different areas of Jewish learning. Mishnah, Gemara, Halachas, of course, and Dinim, as you know. Agodas, this is the non-Dinim section, you know, to learn all kinds of the things that we learn, stories and, you know, favorite expressions and so on. Avol, Balei Kriyim, but those who are suffering from a Bal Keri, Atsur, they are prohibited. Now, why are they prohibited? Of course, again, this is, in other words, we would say that even according to Ezra, people who are suffering from Zohar, remember you asked me that question earlier this evening, right? What is the din? So as we see from here, the din is that they are permitted to learn Torah. They are permitted to say Krishna, etc., etc. They're permitted to do all these things. Yeah. So why not the Bal Keri?
Why not? Okay.
Why not the Bal Keri? So Rashi explains over here, because the Bal Keri did not approach this with this feeling of fear and trembling, etc. When a person is suffering, you know, from Ziva, he's plenty concerned.
Yeah.
So he don't need additional concern, you see, on his part. He already is in a very serious frame of mind when he says Krishna, or when he sits down to learn, you understand? Mm-hmm. But the Bal Keri, he did it because, you know, he's having himself a good time.
He's
having himself a good time. And he should have an attitude of yira, okay? Of fear, trembling, etc. He should be serious about it. So therefore, this is the reason why Ezra said that Hashem is right. He has to title himself before he can learn these, okay? Now, Rabbi Yossi says, Shaina hu birigilios, that if a person is a Bal Keri, he says he can learn, but what can he learn? He can learn things with which he is familiar with. In other words, he shouldn't attempt something new, because that really requires greater concentration, and he doesn't have it at this moment until he is Poibel, so they can have the proper frame of mind. Okay, so he could go over things that he's very familiar with, Regilius, Ragil, or Bilbad, but Shalo Yatsia is a Mishnah. He should not expound on the Mishnah. Rabbi Yonah Simon Yosef Omer, Matsia is a Mishnah. He says, yeah, he can expound on the Mishnah, but Vienna Matsia is a Gemara. In other words, as we see, you know, stages of more difficult learning, okay? He should not expound on the Gemara. Rabbi Nosson Baram Sholem says, Af Matsias HaGemara, he could do that too. But he should not cite God's name as is found in the various quotations within the text. If he would say Hashem, it would be alright, I guess, but he shouldn't say, you know, the actual way that we say it, but we doubt it. Okay. Rabbi Yochanan HaSamlar, Talmido Shel Rabbi Akiva, who was the student of Rabbi Akiva. So Mishum Rabbi Akiva, in the name of Rabbi Akiva, Omer, he says, Lo yikonais l'midrash kalikra, he shouldn't enter into midrash at all. The Yamr law, and there are those who say that what Rabbi Akiva said is Lo yikonais l'beis ha-midrash kalikra, he shouldn't even come into the beis ha-midrash. That's already a little bit too hard. Okay? And Rabbi Yehuda, we finally get back to Rabbi Yehuda. What does he say? Rabbi Yehuda Omer, he says, Shaina hu, he is permitted to learn the Hilchos Derecheretz, right? And so since it says over him Hilchos Derecheretz, then we say that maybe then he equates the idea of Krishna also with Hilchos Derecheretz. Because here is where the who is mentioned. Masa ba Rabbi Yehuda, and now they tell a story about Rabbi Yehuda Shel Ro'o Keri. He happened to notice that he had had an emission. And he was walking by a river. So Amulo Talmidov, so his student said to him, Rabbeinu, Shneilon Perekecha Bihuchos Derecheretz, Rabbi, they said to him, why don't you teach us a chapter in the laws of Derecheretz? Yorad the Tobal, so what did he do? He went down into the river. Tobal, he immersed himself over there, and then they showed to him, and then he taught them. So Amulo, so they said to him, hey, lo kachli maraton rabbeinu. Our master, didn't you teach us shayne hu behilchos derecheretz, that he's permitted to learn hilchos derecheretz? So amar lahem, so he said unto them, afal pi shemekil ani al acherim, even though I am lenient with other people, machmir ani al atzmi, but nevertheless, I am strict when it comes to myself. So we see then that he was makel to other people, that they didn't have to observe this takanot Ezra, and you know they could recite and learn and everything else and so on. But for himself, he felt that he should observe a higher standard of conduct. Yes.
This goes way back. I'm sorry to do this, but about
Right.
Could you just go over that again? What was Rav Yehuda's?
Rabbi Yehuda Omer, Bein Kacha, Bein Kacha. In other words, it wouldn't make any difference, you know, this business, whether it's the bracha before Krishna, the bracha after, right? Whether it is the bracha before Hamotzi, let's say, the Hamotzi, right? Or the bracha, you know, because I was going to say afterwards. There's not a question of doing this for Yirho. Ela Motzi Biswasa. He should actually recite it. He has to mouth the words. He has to recite the words. This is his opinion. Okay, so I think that we'll call it a night over here. We'll stop here this
evening.
We're
on what? On top days.
Yeah, we're on top days, and in the middle, right below the where the lines get bigger, right?
Okay.
Finally, Rabbi Yehuda ben Beseira. So we'll stop him here next week, and Yitzhak Hashem.
Same time, same
place. Same time, same place. Whatever.
So, top days, I'm at Olive.
That's right.
I thought you were going to sit here. I see everybody sitting on one side. I figure you want to sit here to teach.
I know. I'm used to sitting over here all the time, and I give my class.
I figured
right. Okay.
Last week that I wasn't here.
I see.
You never can tell. If you stay away, something might change.
Can't help it. I was too far away to come home.
Yeah, still in Toronto or on your way home?
On the way. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay. So, now, last day, right, I remember we ended up in Chof Beis, just below where the lines stretch out over there. Okay, remember, of course, the problem that we are discussing at this moment is still the Takana of Ezra, you know, that if you want to sit down to learn Torah, or if you want to say Krishna, you have to go and you have to immerse yourself in a mikveh. This was his Takana. The fact that, you know, they tried as much as possible to live up to this takana, to observe it, but nevertheless, they also discovered difficulties and questions in reference to it. So, first of all, we have those, you know, who follow the takana to the greatest extent. Those who say you're not allowed to do anything, you can't learn anything, and so on and so forth, unless you've immersed yourself, and so on and so forth, and of course, as we saw, this is based upon the fact that we have these two psukim, one of them that says, that you shall teach them to your children and to your children's children. And that, of course, refers to Talmud Torah, right? And since Kriya Shema itself is also considered an act of Talmud Torah, so that therefore falls in the same category. And then the verse that follow immediately is Yom Asher Marzal Fnei Hashem Elokech B'chol Rev. Remember that day in which you stood before the Lord your God in Mount Horeb and Mount Sinai. And of course, just as at Mount Sinai, the Baalei Kriyin had to immerse themselves, and also all the men had to refrain from having relations with their wives for 3 days prior to the giving of the Ten Commandments. So from there, Ezra learned the fact that we should observe similarly. But we learned other things too. We learned that, for example, part of the reason was that when we learned Divrei Torah, we shouldn't consider it, or what we say, Krishna, should not be in an attitude that simply, you know, anything goes, or business as usual, or something like that. But right, as we learned, it should be, you know, with fear and trembling, and you should feel that your whole body is immersed in it and everything else. And this is the reason why he decided. Okay? And then they made different gradations, if you remember, as for example, all right, maybe for something of a lesser category, like Hilchus Derech Eretz, it might be permitted, you know, but for something a little bit more severe, like, let's say, Mishnah, it would not be. Then they go from Mishnah to Gemara, or they go, let's say, Medrash, and so on. And there's a difference of opinion as to whether it means Medrash or not. They go even into the base Medrash. And the point is that already is really severe. A person should go into the base Medrash if he has had a seminal admission, right? So the extremist would say, yes, all right, even if he goes in, he should be silent, he shouldn't say anything. It should only be Maharher or something like that, you know, just thinking over, or just listen. But as we see, as we see, I mean, these extremist views, I mean, obviously, they couldn't work out. So we concluded, if you remember, with a little story about Rabbi Yehuda, and his Talmidim said to him, teach us a chapter in Derech Eretz, all right? And as I explained to you, Derech Eretz is the name of one of the Mesechtas Ketanas, one of the very small Mesechtas, which doesn't have the same ranking as any of the great Mesechtas, you know, that are officially part of the Talmud. This is like an addendum, you know, so to speak, to the Talmud, okay? And the opinion had already been voiced, if you remember, that Hilchus Derech Eretz, he did not have to immerse himself, right? And yet, what did Rabbi Yehuda do? They happened to be walking along a riverbank, and what did he do? He went and he immersed himself completely in the river, and then after that he taught them. And they said to him, aren't you being inconsistent with your point of view? Didn't you tell us that you don't have to? So his answer is, of course, a classic answer. He says, even though I am lenient with others, but when it comes to myself, I am a machmir when it comes to myself. And, of course, you know, many authorities take a similar position, not in reference to this particular thing, but in reference to many other things. That, okay, for myself, I want to be extra from, okay? Want to be Mahadran and I'm Mahadran or something like that. But for the average person, it's enough, you know, to simply be, you know, that they do what is right in accordance with the halacha. We can take a simple case. Problem of eating meat, okay? Until really after the war, no one in America, I think, had ever heard of such a thing called as gluttony. I'll be honest with you. I mean, we went into a kosher butcher and we were happy to know.
What war are you talking about?
Before the, not until after the Second World War.
Second World War.
Right,
okay.
Until after the Second World War. I mean, it took the average butcher in America, you know, you relied upon the fact, right, there was kosher meat, and I remember going down to the slaughterhouse and seeing exactly what was doing over there, and, you know, they, right after the Shechita, you had the people who were Boydek. And, you know, they examined the insides, and they examined also the lungs, which is the main thing, you see, the gluttony. And if they found that there was a sircha, so, a sircha means an adhesion on the lung. That's what a sircha is.
They would blow it up.
So, right, they would first of all try to remove it, you know, And then after removing it, then they would test the area underneath where the adhesion was to see whether there had been a perforation or not. Because the din is that if it is perforated, you know, the lung is perforated in that case, it means that the animal is straight. Okay? If, on the other hand, there is no perforation whatever, then in that particular case, the animal is kosher. And they tested it, you know, by putting it like on a jet of whatever it was, hydrogen, helium, whatever they did. You know, they had some kind of a jet in which they tested. Maybe it was just a jet of water. But the point is that they could spot and see whether there was a perforation or not by virtue of the fact, was there anything there or not. And, you know, if the animal was kosher, it was kosher. If the animal was straight, they immediately put an X across the animal to make sure that it would not be confused in the slaughterhouse with, you know, the meat which had been declared kosher. And they had a whole chart, I remember, over there, in which they had a list of various animals, and if it was a trefa, let's say 24 was trefa, or 32 was trefa, or something like that. So that those could be immediately removed after the bedika and immediately passed over to the trefa side of the slaughterhouse.
What's the bedika?
Bedika means investigating it, examining it, right, examining it. Okay, that's the meaning of it. So,
you used the word before, mahadrin?
Mahadrin and abhadrin. It's an expression, you know, that the
what does it mean?
Mahadrin means those who seek to beautify the mitzvah as much as possible. In other words, they wanted to have it with extra refinement, with extra precautions, whatever it may be. This is mahajan.
But isn't that contrary to what we learned, that you're not supposed to add or take away?
Well, it's not adding or taking away. I mean, not changing the mitzvah.
If you add to the mitzvah, you're adding to the requirement.
Well, that depends.
You're changing the Torah.
You make a valid point, but it depends what the addition is or what the subtraction is, you understand? No matter who the mahadrin are, okay, they would not seek, for example, to add a fifth portion, you know, to the tefillah, because we know how many portions are. It's not often the way we say that. There are only four of them, okay? So this is always given as a classic example, you know, of those of people not to add, that you shouldn't have, let's say, you know, four, you shouldn't have five parshas, okay? Or in the matter with the lulav, that you shouldn't have, let's say, more than four minim or less than four minim. It has to be the four species. Well, I wouldn't say the Divrei Rabbanan because of the fact that it's with the Raisa. I mean, the Torah says, I should bind them for a sign upon my hand, they should be in front between my eyes, all right?
Okay.
So, it's commanded by the Torah. Of course, what the rabbis have to do is to come along and define what do we mean by tying them on the hand. Doesn't mean they just tie them around over here. They define, you know, the fact has to be over here on this part of the arm, on the kiboris, as they call it, okay? And, you know, and it has to be, you know, the length of the arm and the hand. That's to fulfill Kshat and Yos HaYudech. The fact that we make, you know, the shin and everything else is already, you know, it's the tradition developed. I mean, that we have seven times over here, and then we make a shin over here, and so on and so forth, in order to demonstrate the name of God. So this already goes way, way back, goes back already to the times of the Talmud, that, you know, this is the way they made it. And then, of course, when it's written, you know, you thought the post being in Ephra, yeah? All right, so of course, obviously the question immediately is, how are you going to put it between your eyes? That's why you put it. If you put it between your eyes over here, needless to say, or over here, I mean,
you wouldn't be able to see it.
You're not Yates, I mean, this is not a place where we're putting the film. Film belongs over here, in the area on which it has to be, okay? And when it says, you know, between your eyes, it means that it should be exactly in the center over here. So, as I say, the rabbis have to come along and explain this, okay? So this is fulfilling the mitzvah, putting on film. Now, what if you try to get the finest pair of tefillin, made of the, you know, the finest skins, you understand?
I understand.
Right. And to make sure that the parchments are written by a most perfect sofer and everything else and so on. You see. So that already is mahadrin. In other words, you're trying to beautify the mitzvah by doing it as perfectly as you possibly can. Okay? So that's what I mean by mahadrin. All right. question is found here and there in the Talmud that Mahadrin, you know, that those, for example, with
experts that we meet in our religion who become radical. There's got to be a foundation somewhere to accept the foundation in, but then when they go beyond...
What I'm referring to.
Right, exactly.
They go beyond and they, in some cases, castigate people who don't follow them into that.
This is where the problem comes.
Exactly. Okay.
You're 100% right about that. In other words, all right, getting back again to the question I didn't, okay. Until people became, people came over to this country after the war, refugees with a Hasidic tradition. Particularly they came from places like, let's say, the Carpathians, Czechoslovakia and so on, from Hungary and so on, where the tradition was that they were not satisfied with meat, which met all the standards of being kosher, except that you had to remove the sircha, you had to remove this adhesion from the lung first, test it out to make sure that it was fine, okay? By then, they wanted to have an animal with lungs which were absolutely perfect, without any adhesions, whatever.
Whether you could remove it or not.
Yeah, whether you could remove it or not, exactly, okay? This was their standard.
This is their standard in the old countries, though?
By the Hasidim, only.
By Hasidim. It was
not all Hasidim either.
Yeah.
That's true.
Maybe not. Maybe not. You're probably right. I mean, after all, people lived in various areas. As I said.
I don't know if it was like that in Lithuania, which was a big.
No, Lithuania was not Hasidim.
No, typical example.
Okay.
Typical example.
You had some, correct. You had in Lithuania, basically, the Hasidim had either the Lubavitcher or you had the Slonim.
You mean to say that all the
big
there were not
to see? Most of them were what we would call misnagdish, if you want to call it. Except that, you see, I don't like the term misnagdish, a lot of people don't like it either, because what is a misnagdish? Misnagdish is literally an opponent. Okay, an opponent to what? Of course, also the Hasidim. This was the term, really, that the Hasidim originally used in order
to derogate,
you know, those who were opposed to Hasidus, you understand? So they usually call them Snagdish. But
a typical example, Phil, of what I'm saying is that the Sapna won't touch Lubavitcher Shtita, and Lubavitcher won't touch Sapna.
In spite of the fact, incidentally, that both of them were even blocked. Or at least they claim that they're blocked.
Who knows?
Okay?
But what I'm saying is that's what I call being prejudiced and extremist, and really, I think it's a novelist.
So why don't you listen to the example of Mahadrim, the mitzvah about Hanukkah?
All right, correct, yes. I started with that when the cassette went off. If you read the Gemara and the Shabbos carefully, okay, you find that in reference to how many candles to light on Hanukkah, okay? So one opinion is that one light is enough for the entire family. One light every night. But then the Gemara says, however, the Mahadrin, they do, either they follow the opinion of Beis Hillel, or they follow the opinion of Beis Shammai. Okay? Beis Shammai says that the first night of Hanukkah you light all 8 lights. And then the next light you light 7. And then the next light after that is 6 and 5 and 4 and so on. I mean, he had a psychological reason. And he had
maybe the oil became less and less day by day.
Whatever you want to say. The point is that, you know, in his opinion, first of all, psychologically, so to speak, the first night is when, you know, you're all keyed up for it. And after that, you get a little bit more used to it and so on, so that it decreases a little bit, okay? But also, you see, he had an example, and that is the example of what they call the Porei Hachag.
What?
Porei Hachag, which means bulls that were sacrificed in the Beis HaMikdash during the festival of Sukkot. If you take a look, when it comes to the sacrifices, the Misafim, you know, the additional sacrifices for the festival of Sukkot, the first day they started with 14. The next day after that it was 13. After that it was 12, okay, and then 11, and 10, and 9, and 8, and finally on Hoshana Rabbah it was 7. Okay, so he had a precedent for his opinion that he followed, that he felt that this should serve as the example for how many lights to light. However, of course, we know that what we do, we follow the opinion of Beis Hillel. And Beis Hillel says that the first night, one, the second night, two, the third night, three, etc., etc. So that when we're doing it, we're really doing this mahadran. We're doing more than just what the basic idea is. But why are we doing it? Because to us, the mitzvah is so beautiful that we want to beautify it by adding more and more lights, you see. And not only that, you want to be more mahadr. So one person, you know, the father of the house, for example, could light for the entire family if he wants. But we encourage children to light their menorahs and things like that. There's another opinion that says even the wife should have her own, although it's not absolutely necessary because, after all, a man and wife count as one body, you see. So this is all in the category of hidur mitzvah. In other words, making the mitzvah that more beautiful. Same thing applies for the lulav and an esrog, for example. You know that you have sets where maybe you can, today's prices it would be $35, $40 a set, and then you can go up $50 a set, $60 a set, $100 a set, I've heard of $200 sets and things like that. So, well, what is it based on? Basically, that they feel that the esrog that they have is more beautiful than the other types of esrog. But are you yotzei with a less expensive one? Of course you are. And there would be some today who feel that in general it's not good, you know, that we encourage people to vie with each other to see if they could have a more expensive thing. Not talking now about the emphasis on more beautiful. I could understand that from an aesthetic point of view. But we also know that with many people, the more that you can tell your neighbor, you know.
Are they more yurtzes? Are they more yurtzes as a result of having paid off?
No, no, they're not.
So what's
precisely not?
Well, here's an example. You know, this brings to mind. How about the mitzvah of building a sukkah?
Right.
Okay, there's a perfect example how a person could mahadran at the mitzvah. By spending more and more effort.
Yeah, on the decorations, paintings, and so on, exactly. No question about that. But certainly yotzei with the sukkah, which has a minimum of decoration. Basically, it's a sukkah if it has four walls, or even three walls, according to one opinion, right? And, you know, it has a covering, the schach, which is kosher, that's it.
Here and there?
Yeah, people used to put chandeliers, right? They would put in the most expensive silverware and all kinds of Talmud mentions that they would put all kinds of expensive cushions.
Primitive living because that's the way our ancestors lived.
Well, but again, this falls into the category, as we say, making the mitzvah beautiful, you see, beautifying it. Zeh keli v'yandehu, this is my God, and the yandehu is taken from the word no'eh, no'deh, in other words, being beautiful. So this is my God and I shall beautify him. I mean, we're not beautifying God, but we're beautifying our way of serving.
Sorry, the Lord.
You know what I said before? You got to be a solid foundation for everybody's presidency. So you'd have the same thing that we spoke before about God.
Right.
You know, with the attitude and interpretation of how they want to observe. And you have the same thing I could see about the Hanukkah candles.
Yeah.
They could be that faction that says, no, you're not supposed to use a candle. Let's say oil.
You're absolutely right. There are some who say that a candle...
You know, they go in electric bulbs, but I'm not...
Yeah, right. Right,
you are. I said something about the other night, a little bit without elaborating about getting credit for what you do if it's within the area, you know, but not for what you don't do. Somebody lit the candle, but then you're going to have Golda Meir, says 100 other presidents that come and tell you.
But you're absolutely right. I mean, technically... Is the electric menorah?
Yes.
Is it yotzei?
Yes.
So you know the arguments pro and con. Those who say no, those who say yes, and so on. I mean, from my point of view, it is, because you know many great authorities feel that it's perfectly acceptable. Okay. There are those who say that you know lighting with a candle, it really should be shemen zayis. It should really be with olive oil because this is considered the most beautiful, the purest. And it's the closest to the original miracle, you see, that took place. So today, it's very true. I mean, that, you know, people would rather light an oil menorah. And because they consider that this is getting closest to
but
the
I like to
yeah.
conclude for myself.
Right.
I don't need that kind
yeah,
of
correct.
Person
right.
To browbeat, you know,
yeah,
and browbeat
right.
Segments,
mm-hmm.
not only the individual. And,
right.
I've seen disruptions here from people.
Oh, yes, no question about that.
I can think of one guy who was even a convert. He married a convert and never had Judaism. I won't mention no names. But then he became an authority on everything.
But you see, Rabbi Yehuda gives us typical answers. It's for me, I'm going to be strict.
Yeah.
For everybody else, they can do what they please.
Yeah, but the point,
as long
the next,
as
the
law.
Point next to
yeah.
it,
yeah.
but the step I
that's
take it from there is his
hot
feet.
Right. I mean, that's why
right.
we remember
yeah.
him.
Yeah. But what I think goes on today
well,
is his attitude about the people that he observed and how they were.
Spirit.
No.
Okay,
let me get right to it, they say. All right. The second long line over there, Tanya Rabbi Yehuda, you see over there?
On
Kaf Beit, Amud Aleph, right. The second long line, third word, Tanya Rabbi Yehuda, then the Sefer. You see that?
Line. Let's see.
Oh, yeah. Down at the end of the first.
Got it?
No, over here.
Okay.
Right. All right?
Thank
good.
You.
All right, now this, Tanya. Now they bring in a quotation from the Tosefta. In the name of Rabbi Yehuda ben Sera, Rabbi Yehuda ben Sera Hoyoimer, he used to say, "Ein divrei Torah mekablin tumo." He said that words of Torah are not susceptible to becoming tomei. Mekabel means literally receive, but it means to be really, in this case,
receive
become susceptible, right, to becoming tomei. Okay, words of Torah cannot do it. But I'll get back to that in 1 second. All right, first let's read this. He says, Ma'ase b'talmid echod, and they tell a story about a certain disciple, of Rabbi Yehuda ben Seira, Shehoye Megam game, the Malam of Rabbi Yehuda ben Seira, who was mumbling in the presence of Rabbi Yehuda ben Seira. Lamala means that he was standing right above him over there, okay? Megam game means mumbling, right.
What's
right.
that word?
Megam game. Right, Megam game.
Sounds almost like
yeah, Megam right, game. Right.
Yeah,
you can see, it's sort of like onomatopoeia, you know?
Right, exactly.
Right.
Megam game.
Yeah. In Hebrew it means either to stammer or to mumble or something like that. This is what the word Megam game means. Also, as I say, it also is
a
use of the stammer. Right, it's a
verb.
Sure. Yeah.
Gum.
So,
he
was mumbling, right above, let's say, where Rabbi Yehuda ben Sera was. Now, obviously, what was he mumbling? The answer is he was mumbling, some quotation or something, Divrei Torah. And the question is, why was he mumbling?
Because he was tomei.
Because, exactly, he had had a seminal omission, and he didn't want to...
go to mikvah.
Exactly. So this was the reason why. All right, so Omalei. So Rabbi Yehuda ben Sera said to him, Bini, he says, son, he says, Pesach Picho, open your mouth, he says, open your mouth wide, right? V'yoyiru devarecho, and let your words shine forth, he says. She'ein divrei Torah mekablin tumo. Because words of Torah cannot be susceptible to uncleanliness, the tumah. Shenemar, as it is written, Halo kol devarai ka'esh teyum Hashem. Are not my words like a fire, saith the Lord. Ma'esh shenem mekabel tumah, just as fire cannot be susceptible to uncleanness. As a matter of fact, we know that fire is one of the agents that we use in order to make
things. Purify
things. Right, to purify, right? But just as fire cannot be susceptible to uncleanness, so ap divrei Torah inom mekabel tumah. So likewise, words of Torah cannot be susceptible to tumah. Okay. Now, what I wanted to get back to was this.
I don't follow this. Now, why was he mumbling? Because
he was mumbling because
he knew that
he was Balkari.
So Balkari.
So he was following the opinion, that the Balkari should not be saying words of Torah because
why was he there?
Huh?
I mean, why was he saying anything? Why
so
was
he came
Balkari?
Because he wanted to hear what Rabbi Yehuda ben Sera was speaking.
Why was he?
This is basically what it was. I don't know whether he was mumbling some sort of an answer, to a question that had been propounded. It's possible. Or maybe Rabbi Yehuda ben Sera made a certain comment and, you know, he wanted to repeat to himself or whatever it was.
Right.
But at any rate, he didn't do it in such a way, right, that because he felt, you know, that following the edict of Ezra, he should not be saying it out loud. So right. Rabbi Yehuda ben Sera points out to him that Divrei Torah, when it comes to words of Torah, there is no tumah. It cannot be susceptible to tumah. And of course, I don't have to tell you that this opinion, number one, throws out the whole business about the Takana of Ezra, because after all, we're saying then, you know, that if this is the case, then we should be able to study Torah, we should be able to say Krishna without all the restrictions, you know, right. that were put upon us, okay? Secondly, there's another application. And this was brought to me by Harav Shenkov Olav HaShalom. The question was raised once in one of our study sessions together. About, you know, the business of women kissing the Torah as it goes by. I don't have to tell you that there are many who feel that a woman should not touch the Torah, okay? Because she may have her period, she's not clean, she hasn't been to the mikveh, whatever it may be, okay? Rabbi Shenkov said that in reality there is no iser, and he quoted precisely this opinion of Rabbi Yehuda ben Sera. In other words, that Divrei Torah ain't no mekablim tumah. They're not susceptible. And therefore, he says, there's nothing wrong with a woman doing it because the Torah itself is like fire,
pure.
Right? And it's pure, and therefore
and
it cannot
make the Torah. Tell me that.
Right. So, I'm very happy to share his opinion with you. And, right. I mean, it doesn't mean that all the women are going to rush now to kiss the Torah, but nevertheless, if they do it, that they have not contaminated the Torah by doing so.
Okay.
What?
Yeah.
I was wondering how far does that go?
In what respect? Go ahead.
No, go ahead. I want to hear what he has.
I was just thinking, if you come into Davin, wash your hands first.
Yes.
Go on up and touch anything. So then, if you go and wash your face, the angle works. Where's Davin? Is it the same thing? Since he's doing that.
Well,
washing
your hands, I don't know whether you're actually getting rid of impurity of tumah itself in the sense in which, you know, but you're absolutely right. I mean, you're supposed to wash your hands before davening because we have a pasuk in Tehillim that says, "Erchatz v'niklayon kapa," I wash my hands in cleanliness. So, and of course, cleanliness is one of the things that should precede godliness, no? So, therefore, we do wash our hands.
Yeah, but you can't get fanatic with it because you can step instantly out somewhere and cut something and the whole thing doesn't work that
way.
But you're applying it.
I'm saying the same thing as I would think would be applied to sitting down one day.
Stanley, there are people who follow your opinion to the T. There's no question about that. Again, as you can see, this is the difference between those who are believing in Hidur Mitzvah, you know, doing things to the nth degree, you know, to make it as beautiful and as meaningful. I mean, I'm not decrying it. On the contrary, I'm praising those who do it. But it doesn't mean that we throw out those who don't do it, you see. That's the difference.
You just brought out my point, but again, you give them credit for what they do, and they don't do it.
But you're right. I mean, from the point of view, you should come with clean hands. I mean, when you wake up in the morning, the first thing you should do is to wash your hands.
So the thing
where
we should wash
before we go down.
Or
yes, so it's in the
Gemara. Yeah, I mean, in the Gemara has it right. And we also had also. I mean, we did learn that you should do, you know, prior to reciting Shemoneh Esrei or something like that. But nevertheless, we learned that what if water is not available?
You could use sand. It was in the
Gemara. So we learned you could use sand. And we learned also, you know, that one of the authorities screamed against those, you know, who go to extremes, to go to a great distance in order to find water to wash their hands. At the same time, they miss the time for saying Krishma, Shmanas, or whatever it may be. More important to daven
and to study.
Right, you see, so that you have a difference of opinion about this.
What's this I see where people don't wash their hands or whatever?
Okay, if that's what they do, the answer is that there are different substances. If you don't have water, then we have other things that you could use to wash your hands, okay? I don't mean to wash your hands, but I mean to cleanse your hands, okay? Right, exactly. So this is a symbolic cleansing of the hands, right? You're putting it against material which automatically would remove the filth, let's say, from your hands before. The basic idea is not to approach with filthy hands, you see. I mean, this we understand. And this is why Jewish law says that when you wake up in the morning, you should wash, first of all. You know, a lot of people have the custom that they keep a pitcher of water with a basin, and they pour it three times over each hand. It's what we call negel dasa. Again, the Hasidim particularly are, follow this.
But I believe that the people that would get obsessed with every fine dot,
yeah,
would have to be held to their obsession for what's really supposed to be doing, you know.
Well,
because this is clouding, clouded with the.
I don't want to appear at this moment that, for example, I'm decrying, this practice. Yeah. I mean, if a person believes that this is the way it should be done, this is the way it should be done. There's a precedent for it. I mean, in the Shulchan Aruch, there's a mention of it. It's no question that you pour, three times over each hand. Now, some do it alternately, which is what the Shulchan Aruch says. Some will do first on one hand, two, three times, and the other. Everybody has his own system. Same thing as when it comes, let's say, to wash your hands before hamotzi. Okay. Some do it this way, this way, this way, this way, and others do it simply.
How many times do you wash your hands with?
Technically, it should be twice. Once on this side and once on this side and so on. This is what it should be. But if you did it only once on each hand, you're also good.
But if you in the morning, you do it three times. For Motzi, you do it only twice.
There's a different reason.
What's the reason?
The reason that the Shulchan Aruch gives for washing it three times in the morning is because they say that there's a ruach roh, there's an evil spirit that hangs around, the filthy germs or something like that. It's an evil spirit. So by washing three times in Chan, you see, so therefore you get rid of the evil spirit. You're set for the day, okay? But for washing the hands before a meal, that is based upon a quotation, a Mishnah that we have, which says that to have clean hands before a meal, you should really wash this, and then they will wash a second time, you understand? So to make sure that both the back and the front of the hand, you see, are clean before you sit down to eat your bread. This is essentially what it is.
Good rule.
Yeah. I don't have to tell you that, we certainly have seen confirmation for the wisdom of these things, that we should be clean, we should wash, and so on and so forth. In our own experience today. But there was a time when water was scarce and people weren't doing these things necessarily. All right. So, to continue.
Well.
All right. Omar. Now he's getting back again to what we learned a couple of lines before. All right. The authority, one of the rabbis had said, Matzia is a Mishnah, and Matzia is a Gemara, right? He says that.
Did you skip
you
what?
Huh?
Did you skip
on that? No.
It's right.
No.
It's okay.
Yeah. Okay. Just before, about the Divrei Torah, right?
Yeah, right.
On the
right.
Okay. So Omar, one of the rabbis has said, Matzia es haMishnah and Matzia es haGemara. This we had several lines up above where we said, that if you have a seminal omission, so there are authorities who say that you can expound Matzia in the sense that, elaborate upon or develop ideas upon the Mishnah, right? But not on the Gemara.
Like suggest, Motzea?
Yeah, Matzia means to delay, it means to suggest. That is absolutely right. Right.
Okay.
Yeah. But here it is used in a somewhat different meaning, as you can see. But it's the same verb, no question about that. And this is why Rashi had to explain what they meant by it, because it was, Matzia normally means, you suggest something. But here it means, like to develop an idea, to expound upon, okay? So, that was a quotation from up above. If you look a little bit before, you'll find it, okay? Just a few lines above, you'll find it. All right. So, Misayale, anyway, he says, this particular opinion, it helps along the opinion of Rabbi Eloi, the opinion that was expressed by Rabbi Eloi. So, Rabbi Eloi, and what was it that Rabbi Eloi said? He said, Omar Rab Acha Bar Yaakov, he said in the name of Acha Bar Yaakov, Mishum Rabbeinu, in the name of our rabbi, who's probably Rabbi Yehuda HaBrasi, Halacha, that the Halacha is Matzia es ha-mishnah, v'yena matzia es ha-gemara. He said that the halacha really is that he is allowed to develop ideas of the mishnah, but not to develop the gemara. So, kitanoi. Kitanoi always means, does this mean then that this is a difference of a point of view which you already find in the earlier authorities in the Mishnah. The Tanoim were the earlier authorities of the Mishnah.
Yeah, right.
So whenever we see Ketanoim, it means either the idea that this argument that we have now between the authorities was already discussed, or it's a question, is it like, and so on. So you don't know at this point, should you read it as a declarative statement, or should you read it as a question? Interrogative. And remember, there's no punctuation over here.
Mm-hmm.
So you have to sort of get the hang of it by reading further, and then you see whether it's one or the other. So he says, Kitanoi. Is this the same as the argument of the Tanoim before, that Matzia is HaMishnah, the Yenu Matzia is HaGemara, Divrei Rabbi Meir? It's mentioned in the Tosefta, it happens, that Rabbi Meir says exactly what we have just said, right? In other words, you're permitted to expound, to develop ideas in the Mishnah, but not in the Gemara. And Rabbi Yehuda ben Gamliel, or Meir, he says, on the contrary, Mishum Rabbi Chanina ben Gamliel, he says in the name of Rabbi Chanina ben Gamliel, Zeh v'zeh also. He says both of these are prohibited. In other words, you're not allowed to expound either Mishnah or Gemara. The Amrei law, Zeh v'zeh mutar. And there are others who say whether one or the other is permissible.
This is after not washing the hands.
Matzia, we had it before the question that you suffered a seminal fall.
Oh,
back again, back again to the Balkari.
Okay.
Okay. We're not finished with the Balkari yet.
All right, okay.
There's a opinion over here.
That was the opening statement.
So we had it above, and now they want to take this statement and analyze it. Is it so the way it says that Matzia is HaMishnah, the inner Matzia is HaGemara, right? So we see now three different points of view.
So
one is that this statement represents Rabbi Meir, then the next statement that says that they're both prohibited, and then the third opinion comes along and says that they're both permitted. That is a mutar. So, man de Omar, the one who says, that's what the mandala means.
Mm-hmm.
Man de Omar, the one who says, Zev is a osur, that, you know, you're not allowed to be Matzia, you're not allowed to expound either Mishnah or Gemara. This is Rabbi Yochanan HaSamla. His opinion follows that of Rabbi Yochanan HaSamla. Man de Omar, Zev is a mutar, and the authority who says that they are both permissible, this is Rabbi Yehuda ben Becerra.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And the other one we said specifically was the opinion of whom? Of Rabbi Meir.
Yeah.
So that we don't have to go over again, all right? Because Rabbi Meir said it, so, you know, they say this was his opinion. All right.
HaSamla is not his name, that's what he did, right?
Yeah. Rabbi Yochanan, Samla means literally Rabbi Yochanan, the sandal maker, the shuster, okay? In those days, of course, they made sandals, you know, the average person wore sandals.
Those days, the rabbis were...
Well, they had to work for a living.
All had
right,
to work for
right.
a living.
Yeah. No, they did. I mean, from being a rabbi, they did not take any pay for it. That's correct. I mean, this is what we learn in Pirkei Avot, for example. When, you know, Hillel makes a statement, for example, that you should not use the crown of the Torah because you'll perish if you do so. It's wrong to do it. Or, as he says, don't make it lo kardam lach papa. Don't use it as a spade to dig with. In other words, you should earn your living, you know, in a different way. Of course, under today's circumstances, already it's a different problem. And you know, in the Middle Ages, they also already recognized that you know, this had become a problem for Jewish community, because a person was to develop his was to spend his whole time in Torah and acting as a communal leader and so on and so
teaching,
forth.
So.
Right, that he didn't have time to go and stay in the marketplace and try to sell herring. But nevertheless, I'm not kidding. Chofetz Chaim refused to take a penny for teaching. And he was already, you know, the 20th century, the Chofetz Chaim. Passed away when it's about 1930 or something like that. He was there. Forget the exact year. But, you know, he's practically our contemporary, the Chofetz Chaim. And yet, you know, either he or his wife would earn their living by selling herring in the marketplace. And when he saw that you know, the other people were selling, people were coming over to do business with him because they wanted to give him, you know, the lazing, as we would say,
to earn the money
and so give him the trade. So he said this was wrong, that they had to patronize the other people. They had to make a living as well. This was the caliber of the Chofetz Chaim. This is why he's really one of the great sainted characters of our age. All right, so at any rate, we see that then there is an opinion that says nothing doing. That was Rabbi Elai, right? And the other one, you know, who said, it was Rabbi Yehuda ben Gamliel, the name of Rabbi Chanimah, who said that they both prohibited. And the other one, who said it was permissible, this we said was the, the other one went back to Yochanan Assembly. He said that he was the earlier authority who had prohibited. And the one who said it was permitted went back to Rabbi Yehuda ben Maser and said he was the one who had permitted it. So Omer Rab Nachman by Yitzchok. So Rab Nachman by Yitzchok said, now this is already a later authority, as you can see. First of all, I want to point out that Tanoyim usually had the title Rabbi in front of it. Okay, they normally had it, right? Okay. The later authorities had the title Rav, but not Rabbi. And the reason for that was a historical reason. And this involved what we call smicha. Now today, when we speak about smicha, we mean ordination, of course. You know, every rabbi should receive ordination. But in ancient times, smicha was a more complicated thing than today. I mean, today you take all kinds of tests, I mean, to show your
confidence.
Your competence, right, and the Shulchan Aruch and so on and so forth. You can discuss Torah and things like that, you know, and then they write out, you know, yor, and so on, okay? That you can, yor means that you can decide questions of, you know, what's permissible, what's prohibited, and so on and so forth. Yod means that you can serve as a dayan in the court and decide things in accordance with Jewish halacha. You know, if litigants come and they want a din Torah, so you're competent enough in order to issue the
opinion.
The opinion, right, that you can give an authoritative opinion, is what I meant. Okay? On the other hand, in ancient times, smicha involved, you know, again, getting this permission, but it meant that you had permission from the head of the originally of the Sanhedrin, later on of the Beis Din in Yavne, and whoever was the leading authority, and it was good only in Eretz Yisrael, that is, only those who had studied in Eretz Yisrael were given the permission to have the title Rabbi and to have formal smicha. Understand? But if you were, for example, a student of the Babylonian academies, then unless you came there to Israel and demonstrated, you know, your competence, then you could not assume the title Rabbi. Okay? And there are other restrictions. I mean, this is discussed primarily in the Gemara Sanhedrin. This is where they go into this question of ordination. But the later authority.
You receive from the Sanhedrin? Right?
Yeah. Right. Well, any competent musmach had the authority to do others. Unless, for example, in the case of it was Rabbi Yehuda ben Seira, I think it was, if I'm not mistaken. In the time of Roman persecution, they had prohibited the study of Torah. So he took five of his leading disciples and he gave them smicha, gave them the authority, in other words, to be called Rabbi and everything else. And then the Romans discovered him and they shot him full of arrows,
right,
and spears and everything else, you know, and they killed him. Because he dared to violate the Roman edict against it. But nevertheless, he was concerned that it was more important than his life was the fact that Jewish learning, Jewish authority with contingency, so that any competent Muslim can give smicha. Today the rule is still the same. I mean, if a person is a competent Muslim, he can also give smicha. This is why we have what we call private smichas. Okay? In other words, a rabbi gives smicha. But the tendency today is that instead of private smicha, it should be an ordination, it should be a smicha from a recognized yeshiva, right? No, from recognized yeshiva. So this is smicha today. Alright. So at any rate, getting back over here. Alright, so Rav already indicates that Rav Nachman by Yitzchak was a later authority. So it says Rav Nachman by Yitzchak Nahug Almo Kahanit La Sabek. He made a statement that the Olam Almo is like, you know, the Aramaic for the Hebrew Olam. In other words, the Gans of Elf, you know. The Gans of Elf, Tiltzich, says the whole world acts in accordance with these three elders, these three sages, in other words. Anit Lasabe. Who are they? It's Karabi Eloi, the Rashis Hagez. They follow Rabbi Eloi in the question of Rashis Hagez. I'll come back to that in a moment. Karabi Yoshi or the Kilayim. They follow the rule of Rabbi Yoshi when it comes to Kilayim. And Karabi Yehuda ben Besera, and they follow the opinion of Rabbi Yehuda ben Besera, but Divrei Torah when it comes to learning Torah. All right, and now he goes into the explanation of each one. Rabbi Eli, Bereshis Hagez, they follow the opinion of Rabbi Eli when it comes to Bereshis Hagez. Now, what is Bereshis Hagez? Well, we read this in the end of Parsha, towards the end of Parsha Re'eh, several weeks ago, where it is written that, a couple of other places as well, that the first wool that grows during the year, you have to take the very first, not the complete wool, I mean, I don't mean the whole thing, but you have to take a flock of wool when you shear it, in other words, the first shearing, and you give that as a matana to a kohen. Well, that's where you have plenty of people, you know, and each one takes, you know, from this sheep, and sheep. Even one person, let's say they had a flock of 100 sheep. So, you know, the first shearing of each one, you know, he gave a matana to the Kohen, okay? So that the Kohen could then use the wool for whatever he wanted. He could sell it in the marketplace, or he could use it to write for clothing, or whatever it may be, okay? So this is a matana, one of the matnos kahuna, one of the gifts that the people have to give the Kohen in days of old, when the Beis HaMikdash was in existence. All right, now, what was this particular law that he gave? So, okay, in the law of Reishis Hagez, Rabbi Eli Omer, he says that Reishis Hagez eino noheg elo ba'oretz. He says this law applies only in Eretz Yisrael. In Eretz Yisrael, there you have to follow out this edict and give to the kohen. Even in Eretz Yisrael today, they don't do it. Frankly, they hardly raise any sheep today in Eretz Yisrael. But, you know, that's besides the point. The point is that he said only in Eretz Yisrael is this an applicable halacha, but let's say you have flocks, you know, in countries other than Eretz Yisrael, in that case, you don't have to give the Reishis Hagez. So, the halacha follows his opinion over there. Alright, now we come to the next one. And, Rabbi Yoshia, halacha follows Rabbi Yoshia. Big Kilayim. In Kilayim. Now, the question is, what are Kilayim? Okay, this needs a definition too. There's a law in the Torah which says Lo Sizra Kamechor Kilayim. Okay, you're not allowed to sow your vineyard as Kilayim. Okay, and then there's a further elaboration which says also you're not allowed to sow Chita Seora. You're not allowed to sow wheat and barley at the same time. Okay,
and also to yoke the ox and the
That was exactly right. Right.
What's
Kilayim? Kilayim means a mixture, a prohibited mixture. That's exactly what it means, okay? So, as a matter of fact, we refer to shatnez also as being Kilayim, except that it's Kilayim of a beggar. In other words, if you would have a garment which contains at the same time wool and linen, this is prohibited. Wool and cotton is permitted. woolen rayon is permitted, woolen nylon is permitted, but not woolen linen. This is a prohibited mixture. Okay.
Well, they say something about it going back to Cain and Abel.
Yeah, I mean, there are various explanations given why this is so, but the truth of the matter is the Torah does not really explain it to any great extent. This is in the category of laws that the Torah mentions in what we call chukim. In other words, the Rabbeinu Shlomo said, don't do this, and so on. Yeah, the Torah Adum is an option like that. Okay. Even kashrus is also, frankly.
Right.
I mean, all the laws that we have, whether it's not the blood, I mean, we could figure out sanitary reasons why or aesthetic reasons why we shouldn't do it, okay?
Against but nevertheless, the natural inclination of
right. I mean, and naturally, you know, people like the Rambam very often try to find, you know, some philosophical reason for it as well, besides the fact that it's a law, this is what we have to observe. But essentially, it comes back again to the fact that, why don't we? Because the Ben Ishalem said in the Torah, no, we're not allowed. This is the basic idea, okay? So, all right. So what was the halacha that he cited that the opinion they excited that they accept this halacha? Kedichsev, it says it's written lo sizra kilayim. You see, there are two different readings. One is lo sizra kilayim, the other one is lo sizra kamet kilayim. This is why you have all these parentheses over here, because the question is which one. But at any rate, if we take the simplest idea, lo sizra kilayim, do not sow kilayim. Okay. So Rabbi Yoshi says, Li Oilam Eino Chayav, he says, a person really does not become liable for violating the law of Kilayim Ad She Yizra Chito Seorah V'Chatz Ban Pelus Yad, until he actually takes some wheat, some barley, and also the seeds of grapes, and he scatters them all at the same time. Then he is really violating the laws of Kilayim. Otherwise, it's a violation, but it's not as serious a violation as the other. So they follow his opinion that if you do all three at one shot, then this is really a violation.
Mm-hmm. But if you mix it together and you didn't
put it apart. Exactly.
It's like having a chutzpah,
Yeah, right, absolutely so. Now, Rabbi Yehuda ben Maseiro, and they follow the opinion of Rabbi Yehuda ben Maseiro, but they're right over. Comes through the words of Torah. The Tanya, as we have learned, Rabbi Yehuda ben Maseiro Omer, he says, Ein divrei Torah mekablin tumah. What we learned just above,
right.
That the words of Torah cannot be susceptible to tumah. So therefore, what do we learn? So from this, we learn then that if we follow the opinion, if we say that the halacha follows Rabbi Yehuda ben Maseiro, then in that particular case, we don't have to anymore immerse ourselves in the mikvah prior to learning whatever branch of learning it is, or prior to saying Krishna. Okay? In other words, obviously it became, too difficult to follow, and this is the reason why when Rabbi Yehuda ben Maseiro issued, his psak that Ein Divrei Torah Mekablim Tumah, which is a very logical thing, totally based upon look. The words of the Torah like fire, and fire cannot ever be susceptible to it. So he has a good drash, in order to back up his point of view. So we follow the opinion of Rabbi Yehuda ben Maseiro in this case. Ki osa zayiri, but doesn't mean that everybody, immediately jumped on the bandwagon and said, hooray, let's accept the opinion. When zayiri came, now whenever it says ki osa, what it usually means is that, this particular scholar had spent time studying in Eretz Yisrael, and then he came to
Babylonia.
He came to Babel. And, actually they wanted to find out, so tell us, what did you learn in Eretz Yisrael? So, he would give them, things that he had learned in Eretz Yisrael. So, Kiyosu Zahiri, when Zahiri came, so Omar, he said, Bidluha Litvilusa. He said that the din is that they have cancelled out Tevlin. They've cancelled it out. In other words, immersing yourself in the mikvah. It's cancelled it out. The Amr law, but there are those who say, Bitluha l'netilusa. Other authorities say what they cancelled out was washing the hands. Gets right back to what we were discussing earlier. Okay. So, Mando Amar Bitluha l'netilusa. So now he explains. The authority who says that what they canceled was the tevilah, in other words, you know, going and immersing yourself in the mikvah before this. So that's Rabbi Yehuda ben Beseira. Then in this case, he followed the opinion of Rabbi Yehuda ben Beseira. Ma'am the Yomah, the authority who said what they canceled out was the gluho l'mtiluso, washing the hands, so it's kehoda rav chisto. So this was in accordance with the statement.